This is me telling you this. The program is Media Network.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another program from the Media Network Vintage Radio Archive.
By shortwave and satellite, this is Radio Netherlands. Media Network, a weekly survey of international communication developments. Produced and presented by Jonathan Marks.
Oh, hello there. With this already? Well, I've actually been brushing my teeth with a new Japanese toothpaste called On Air. A tube of this stuff was presented to me by a regular Far Eastern traveller with the comment that this must be just the toothpaste for broadcasters. True to any TV commercial, the on-air toothpaste takes your dragon's breath away but replaces it with the dubious taste of strawberries. Actually, it does taste rather odd. I only hope that the rest of the Japanese characters on the tube, which of course I can't decipher, aren't really telling me that this stuff kills 99% of household germs and is great for reaching those hard-to-see areas just round the bend. Well, enough nonsense. Let's have a look at what's happening on the dial. Sunday, November the 1st, saw quite a few changes, in fact. Radio Beijing has now appeared daily on 3985 kHz in Europe via relay facilities in Switzerland. You can hear programmes in German at 21 hours UTC, followed at 21.30 by French, 22 hours in Italian, and at 22.30 in English.
We'll be back on the air again tomorrow night between 22.30 hours Greenwich Mean Time and 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time on 3985 kHz in the 75 meter band.
And that was reception here in Hilversum last night. On 6165 kHz, half-hour programmes in Chinese, Serbo-Croat, Spanish and Portuguese are being put out from Switzerland too, thanks to a second satellite feed from Beijing. But in this part of Europe, reception is impossible between 21 and 23 hours, as the signal is completely buried under Radio Havana, Cuba. In North America, though, a very strong signal from Radio Beijing is being heard on 9770 kHz between midnight and 03 hours. Lou Josephs in Boston reports that programmes in English and Chinese are being noted, but that particular frequency of 9770 isn't being announced. It's extremely strong in North America, unlike the announced channel of 9665 kHz running in parallel. So, is there some relay coming from somewhere, he wonders. Likewise, 11790 kHz in Spanish, between 23 hours and midnight, is unusually strong, again from Radio Beijing. Suggestions welcome. Meanwhile, what's called the Global Radio Corporation of Opelika, Alabama, USA, has been writing to international broadcasters again, asking for transcription programmes. This latest release from the NDXE group claims that programmes on shortwave will start very soon.
Radio Netherlands. We're not number one. You are.
Following the large number of requests for Dave Rosenthal's fact sheet on propagation via meteor scatter, we've hooked up a line again this week, this time to talk about an increasingly common problem. You're probably listening to this programme indoors, but is your receiver in front of you protected against electrometeors? Well, first of all, Dave, what are they?
Electrometeor is a general term in the weather business for any visible or audible manifestation of atmospheric electricity. Actually, we're interested in a more specific type of electrometeor, what's called an igneous meteor, lightning. Lightning and the strong bursts of radio frequency energy it creates. Bursts big enough to do damage to delicate, unprotected equipment. Lightning for most people in the world represents one of the most violent energy releases of nature. For shortwave listeners, lightning can be especially violent to those sensitive collectors of radio energy we call receivers. Lightning, after all, is basically an electrical spark. And electrical sparks couple a goodly amount of their energy into the radio frequency portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. Your receiver is happy to receive RF signals at the microvolt level. A nearby lightning discharge can deliver hundreds or thousands of volts to it. Considering all this can take place in a few microseconds, it's not a pretty picture if you happen to be a solid-state radio.
We've received quite a few letters from listeners complaining that their receiver either suddenly became very insensitive or the controls froze up and would only work normally again when all the radio's batteries were first removed and then put back again. Can your radio be damaged even when you're using an indoor antenna?
Actually, damaging RF input overloads from nearby lightning can be a hazard to any listening scheme. This is why professionals in the radio business use lightning protectors and a host of other surge-stopping devices. By and large, indoor antennas like attic long wires or an active antenna in a high-rise building are certainly safer from a direct lightning hit. But more importantly, the structure often offers some protection from the intense RF bursts created by nearby lightning discharges. Carefully tuned outdoor antenna schemes are far more susceptible to lightning-caused RF overloads. And if your particular system isn't protected, a passing electrometeor just might drop in.
So, how does lightning produce all this radio frequency energy? We need to analyze what's happening in that flash of light.
In what's called a lightning discharge, an irregular but basically tubular path called a lightning channel gets blasted through the air to connect masses of opposite electrical charge. The lightning channel, actually a plasma tube, is the luminous spark we see during thunderstorms. Inside the lightning channel, the electrical resistance is virtually zero, and enormous amounts of charge get transferred in a very rapid series of current surges. Each current surge is called a lightning stroke, and the combination of all this current plus fast rising strokes releases wide-band pulses of RF electromagnetic energy. Typical electric current in each lightning stroke is about 20,000 amps. Typical current flow rise time is about half a microsecond. With these numbers, you can observe RF energy in a frequency range from less than 10 kilohertz to beyond 10 gigahertz. The lower in frequency you go, the higher the lightning's energy density, with the HF end of the spectrum particularly hard hit. When a lightning discharge takes place near your antenna, enough RF energy can be coupled into it to induce very high but virtually instantaneous voltages. In a protected system, a lightning arrestor would sense this high voltage and shunt it to ground before it hit your receiver's front end. In the past, this has been done by attaching each of the antenna's two lead-in wires to one side of a narrow air gap. The other side of the narrow air gap was connected to a good earth ground. When a nearby lightning stroke occurred, the high lightning-induced voltage on the lead-in wires would cause the air in the air gap to break down and conduct, just like in the lightning channel. In the presence of this very conductive path, the lightning-induced voltage would just be shunted to ground. This was a great solution back when tube-based receivers were common. But now, with super-sensitive solid-state components making up the front ends of receivers, a simple air gap-based lightning arrestor might neither act fast enough nor adequately enough to prevent damage. Lately, we're seeing lightning arrestors featuring gas discharge tubes, which break down and conduct at much lower induced voltages, and much more quickly. This type of device can be connected to coax or wire antenna lead-ins. Several models are available now for about $20 US, and it's about the simplest and most sensible method of lightning protection.
So, can these gas discharge lightning arrestors really provide all the protection that you need?
Actually, no lightning protection scheme will do you any good unless you have a good earth ground. Lightning RF pulses are referenced to the electrical potential of the earth, and if your lightning arrestor isn't connected to it, you still have a problem. Installing a good earth ground should be an important part of any listening setup, since radio signals are earth referenced too. This can make a bigger difference than you might think. Massive is the key word in grounding. Use large diameter solid conductor copper cable if you can get it. Make your cable run as short as possible to a large copper stake driven into the ground. The longer the stake and the deeper it goes, the better. What? You don't have your own copper mine? Well, then improvise by finding an old copper auto radiator. Clean it up, solder a cable to it, and bury it. A friend of mine does quite well with an old copper fire extinguisher buried under his window. Just use as large a conductor as you can, and keep cable runs as short and as straight as possible. This will help to minimize the electrical inductance of your ground run, an especially significant factor with the fast rise times and high currents of lightning. In big apartment buildings, your best bet may be the good old cold water pipe. Some people like to try the grounded terminal on the electrical outlet, but that might be asking for trouble noise-wise. You should look for the connection that best connects to the grounded structure of the building. Just remember that although it may be grounded, a large steel building framework still has inductance and could pose a problem with very close lightning discharges. This could be especially true with active antennas grounded to a steel building frame. However you do it, once you've established a good earth ground, then connect your lightning arrestor.
Obviously, the more expensive your radio, the more trouble you'll probably take to make a good antenna and earth connection. Several thousand thunderstorms take place every day, though of course their intensity varies widely.
Success. His needs are more, so he gives less. They call him the winner who takes all, and he strikes.
A lightning arrestor is a bit of a misnomer, though.
All we've discussed today is based on nearby lightning discharges. If lightning actually hit your antenna, the vapor you'd smell would be your antenna. Your lightning arrestor might have saved your radio, but you'd probably be more interested in firefighting than DXing at that point. Lightning arrestor or not, if you have a very intense thunderstorm in the immediate neighborhood, it might be wise to disconnect your antenna altogether until it blows over. With that, I'll close from this end, Jonathan. For the research file, I'm Dave Rosenthal.
Actually, before you go, Dave, just how close should you let an intense thunderstorm get to you before you consider disconnecting the receiver's antenna?
Well, Jonathan, I'd say within a kilometer or two, depending on the intensity of the storm. Actually, the most common type of lightning discharge is from cloud to cloud rather than from the cloud to the ground. This puts the entire lightning channel in the sky and increases the radiative efficiency of its RF pulse. Between overhead cloud-to-cloud discharges and nearby cloud-to-ground strikes, some pretty hefty voltages can couple into your radio, even if it's off. Lightning caused transients delivering as little as tens of microwatts to sensitive solid-state components have been known to destroy them.
Next from the Netherlands, shortwave equipment news.
With the nights getting longer here in Holland, it's time to do some more technical tests on new shortwave receivers. Joining me is Carl Josephs to help evaluate one that's been on the European market for about 3 weeks.
The Japanese Panasonic company has launched a new travel portable radio called the RFB40L, the letter L standing for long wave coverage on models sold in Europe and the Middle East. It's about the size of a paperback book, measuring 180 by 109 by 36 millimetres and weighs 574 grams when fitted with the four internal Penlight batteries. In fact, around this time last year, we reviewed a receiver from the same company called the RFB60L. As the type number implies, this is a cheaper portable receiver than last year's model. What they've done is to take off some of the features seen on the RFB60L and build it into a smaller case.
Whether they've stripped off too many features depends on what you're planning to do with such a receiver. The set covers long wave between 146 and 288 kHz, medium wave between 522 and 1611 kHz, and provides continuous shortwave coverage between 1611 and 29995 kHz. VHF FM between 87.5 and 108 MHz is also offered. On models sold in West Germany and Italy, though, the coverage of the receiver is partly restricted in the shortwave range.
The set is designed for listening to broadcasting stations only. There's no provision for single sideband reception, so listening to radio amateurs or ships at sea is technically impossible. The RFB40L can be tuned in one of two ways. On the front is a block of 12 dark grey keys, similar in layout to a pocket calculator. 10 of the buttons correspond with the digits 0 to 9. There's one for the decimal point and a button for storing chosen frequencies in the memory.
So if you wanted to select Radio Netherlands on 9895 kHz, you press a button marked frequency and then tap in 9895 and push the enter button. If you push 9.895, you'll get the same result. Should you push 98.95, the receiver automatically assumes you mean 98.95 MHz VHF-FM, and that indicates the use of very user-friendly software for the microprocessor which controls the receiver.
Each of the 12 push buttons on the keypad also has a small text on it, corresponding to the 12 different broadcast bands between 2 and 30 MHz. If you're on your travels and can't recall where the 25-metre band starts, for instance, you simply push a button marked meter band, and by pressing key number 8 on the panel, the set springs to 11650 kHz. That is the lower frequency end of the 25-metre broadcast band.
Manual tuning is offered too. If you want to move up the shortwave dial, let's say, you can press a button and the set jumps by 5 kHz to the next channel. If you keep that button pressed, the receiver continues to move up the dial at the rate of about 50 kHz a second. On medium wave, you can select whether the receiver moves in 9 or 10 kHz in one step. And on long wave, the steps are 9 kHz. On VHF-FM, they work out at 50 kHz per step. But note that if I press the button to move up the dial, you can get this. That's right, silence in between, as the set mutes as it scans.
Unfortunately, unlike its more expensive brother, the RFB40L does not offer any form of fine-tuning control. The single bandwidth filter is 6 kHz wide at minus 6 decibels and offers only a mediocre shape factor. In practice, that means if you're listening to Radio Australia in the European afternoons on 6035 kHz, let's say, and the Voice of America starts up on nearby 6040 kHz, reception of Australia is severely hampered by splash from VOA to the point of being unlistenable. On a cheap receiver, the shortcomings of the bandwidth filter can sometimes be reduced by slightly off-tuning by a few kHz or so, but this is impossible on the RFB40. This means you're confined to listening to the stronger international broadcasters on this receiver.
Some thought has gone into the set's design, though. A physically handicapped person can tune the set and store frequencies into the memory by using one finger. There are 9 memories for favourite FM channels, 9 for shortwave, and a further 9 are available for either medium or longwave frequencies. There's a lock switch on the side of the set, which can be set to disable all the buttons on the front of the receiver. Whilst that may be handy to freeze the settings while you're travelling and listening on a bus, let's say, it doesn't prevent the receiver accidentally being switched on in transit, say in a suitcase. The on-off sliding power switch is not recessed, and so it's quite easy to arrive at your destination with flat batteries. The receiver uses some 80 milliamps when in operation, which is quite high battery power consumption for a portable radio. In Europe, the set comes with a transformer unit as part of the price and works out some 300 times cheaper to operate it from the household AC current supply.
The LED tuning indicator on the RFB40L is more for show than as a tuning aid. On shortwave, congestion on the bands ensures that's permanently on. The telescopic whip antenna extends some 73 centimetres, but the last section is very thin indeed and quite easily bent out of shape as you try to retract it after use. Although some versions of this set are sold with provision for an external aerial, connecting an outdoor antenna causes a sharp rise in internally generated spurious signals. An external aerial is therefore not really recommended unless you live in a very remote part of the globe. A single-step attenuator is included, which helps when the receiver is overloaded by very strong signals on, say, the 41 or 49-metre band in Europe. At a price of around £156 in Europe, this receiver is rather expensive, bearing in mind competing receivers from, amongst others, Sanjin, Philips, Sony, and even the Panasonic RFB60L, which is £30 more expensive. The advantages are ease of operation, size, weight, and good audio quality. The main disadvantages are the inability of the set to tune in increments of less than 5 kHz, rather high battery consumption for a portable, and the price.
We were talking there about the Panasonic RFB40L, and my thanks there to Carl Josephs for his help.
My pleasure, Jonathan. Hey, can you smell strawberries in here?
No. We move back to Telecom 87 and the programme I presented last week from the world's largest telecommunications exhibition in Geneva, Switzerland. I confess that after battles with the ITU press office to convince them that we didn't need two television cameras for the broadcast, just some tape recorders, I was somewhat exhausted by the time it came to make the programme. In fact, I said 623 kHz was one of the shortwave crystals on board the pop music ship Radio Caroline. And, of course, I really meant 6230 kHz, as many of you spotted. It seems the North Sea broadcaster also tested 5955 kHz exactly a week ago today, just before Radio Netherlands' Flevo transmitter site started using the channel at 1130 UTC. The surprise lunchtime test did originate aboard the Ross Revenge, we're told. It certainly wasn't some prankster at our transmitter site. Well, few companies at last week's Telecom let you look into their research projects, but there were some exceptions. On the American AT&T stand was a brown-looking substance in a beaker of liquid nitrogen. Above this material was a small common magnet, spinning in mid-air, appearing to defy gravity. The card above it explained that this was a demonstration of superconductivity. So I asked Don Murphy, who's head of solid-state chemistry and ceramics at AT&T's Bell Laboratories, what was the connection between superconductive materials and communications?
Right now there's no direct connection, but these superconductors are one of the most fascinating electronic properties known to man, and just within the last year it's been possible to have that property, which is basically zero resistance to the flow of electricity, above liquid nitrogen temperature. This is something that scientists have dreamed about ever since the phenomena was first discovered in 1911 by the Dutch physicist Kamerlingh Onnes. We believe that they would have vast implications in the electronics industry. 60% of a circuit board is covered basically by conducting paths, and if that conducting path could be made more efficient, it might have vast implications. Interconnections, etc.
So what are some of the substances being used, or is that a trade secret?
The main materials are all ceramic-type materials based on copper oxide with other what we call ternary elements added, such as yttrium and barium is the most popular at the moment, rare earth and alkaline earth materials.
But even if they were developed industrially, wouldn't you have a problem that you'd have to keep all your equipment at liquid nitrogen temperatures?
Yes. At the moment, that's true. But right now, we don't really know, on a theoretical level, why these materials superconduct at as high a temperature as they do. Until a year ago, the highest critical temperature known was 23 degrees. This is four times as high as that. We feel that if we understood them better, it's possible that the critical temperature may rise, even above room temperature. But even if the critical temperature stays where it is, which is in the range of 90 to 100 degrees Kelvin, above liquid nitrogen temperature, that there may be some uses that actually justify the cost of cooling and expense of cooling with liquid nitrogen.
That was Don Murphy. On February the 9th next year, an Ariane rocket is due to launch, amongst other payloads, the largest and most exciting amateur radio satellite so far. Called Phase 3C, it's currently in West Germany for the final preparations. The amateur satellite organization AMSAT has now launched an appeal to raise the $10,000 needed to insure the satellite against a possible launch failure. Remember back in 1979, there was hope amongst the shortwave broadcasters at least that many of the utility stations, such as press bureaus or embassies and the military, would gradually switch to satellite communications, leaving more room for expansion of the broadcast bands on shortwave. Although Telecom 87 was full of satellite technology, there's a lot of traditional shortwave communications material around too. I asked Patrick McLaughlin of the American Harris Corporation whether, in the long term, there's still a move to phase it out.
No, that's rubbish, as we spoke of before. There's no way shortwave is being supplanted by anything. This show is addressing a completely different area. The reason that Harris brought a transceiver with us was because a lot of our customers are here that would be interested in this. PTTs, for instance, government agencies, customs houses, internal security forces, people that use data communications, but also have a need for the long distance as well.
But you have the problem that you've got to work via the ionosphere and presumably can't send data as fast because of all the fading as you can via a satellite link.
Well, that's true. HF is band limited in that I can't send 10 megabits over the ionosphere. But I can send a 2400 bits per second channel over the ionosphere, no problem. Harris manufactures a modem specifically designed for that.
And is it reliable?
Absolutely. 100% reliable, as long as the operators choose the right frequency and understand the propagation conditions of the ionosphere, you can have totally reliable data communications on HF.
And presumably this is extremely important when either the satellite fails or in times of conflict.
Well, of course, we sell it. As in fact, one of my key marketing points to stress with customers is the fact that HF is their backup. Whenever their main trunking goes down, they always have that one or two channel or sometimes four ISB, a four channel system that's ready to go up anytime.
Now back to the bands. And Austrian radio has changed some of the times for its weekly 15-minute media program called Austrian Shortwave Panorama. It's now on Sundays at 02 hours UTC, with repeats at 08:15, 12:30, 14:30 and 18:05 UTC the same day. Meanwhile, up on the new 21-metre band, one of the US religious stations has started using 13695 kHz for afternoon broadcasts to Europe. It's WYFR and it's noted here at 16:30. The transmissions of Radio Suriname International via Brazilian transmitter have improved their audibility since Sunday. The new channel is 17837 kHz, with Dutch programmes starting at 17 hours UTC, and a short English news bulletin around 45 minutes later.
This is an outstanding from Radio Suriname International.
And here on Radio Netherlands, we bring up the line to Colombo, Sri Lanka, where Victor Gunatilaka has just reported an interesting medium wave catch. Victor.
Yes, Jonathan, the medium wave band still continues to bring in the thrills for me. This time, my excitement or the star logging has been Radio VKW. That's the voice of the Cocos Islands. That's the Cocos and Keeling Islands. This Australian territory broadcasts on 1404 kHz. That's 1404 kHz using just 100 watts. I was thrilled to hear the station with a relay of Radio Australia, and the program manager, Ron Carey, has just sent me a QSL card. They relay Radio Australia most of the time, and the station manager goes on to say that from 3 p.m. to 6:20 p.m. local time in the Cocos, the station is entirely managed by a junior staff with also a junior program manager. The ages of the program announcers and managers vary between 9 to 16 years.
Well, thanks, Victor, for that update. Sounds fascinating listening.
Some stations talk to the world. Radio Netherlands talks to people.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website.
This is Media Network with Jonathan Marks,
where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.
I regret to inform you this recording is now officially over.